Good morning.
It just does.
My name is Hoyun Nam. I'm a shareholder at Better Price, focusing on maritime finance matters. These are interesting times for the maritime industry and its capital providers. Many owners are still flushed with cash. The order book is low. Many segments in the market, in the industry, are in a healthy state, making money for their stakeholders. There are, however, some dark clouds potentially gathering in the horizon, whether it's the fate of the high interest rate, political events around the world, including some significant elections happening this year, banking and environmental regulations, the world economy, including China's. I'm here to discuss what that all means for maritime finance with four distinguished panelists. In no particular order, I have Mr. Michael Parker, Chairman, Global Shipping, Logistics, and Offshore, Citi; Mr. Martin Hugger, Managing Director, Mirabaum Capital Solutions; Mr. Evan Cohen, Managing Director and Head of Maritime Finance, First Citizens Bank; Mr. Harris Antoniou, Managing Director, Neptune Maritime Leasing. Welcome. So I'd like to start off by discussing the state of maritime finance generally today. Volumes are very low because of strong earnings and less refinancing. A banker friend of mine recently told me that even though his organization had a very busy year, 2023, it's still very hard to keep up with the amount of prepayments and to maintain a book. So I'll start with you, Martin. How is the market, and how is Mirabaum Capital doing?
Does that go by itself here? Yeah, okay, perfect. So for us, it's has been a while now. We started off in this business in 2016, 17, and we thought, okay, few banks left. Fine, we go in with money, and we have the smaller and mid-sized owners to finance their purchases. And at some stage, the banks will come back. And looking into it, it actually hasn't happened. And the question for us is mostly why hasn't it happened? And it looks as if Basel and the rules and regulations that are imposed on banks makes it very, very difficult to finance a cyclical industry. And cyclical industry is what shipping is. You make tons of money in this business, but it's so cyclical that the rating of bank finance is very cyclical as well. And that means for the banks, they have to manage it somehow. And if the banks don't manage it, they have analysts' calls and chairmen that say, "Why do I need to allocate double, triple the equity?" So that means banks have been more careful, banks have been focusing on the large guys, and banks have been doing everything they can to bring the volatility down and at the same time make shipping attractive to people that say, "Transporting coal, transporting oil, oh, how dirty." And this is what made a huge gap for guys like us. We don't have the constraints that banks have. We don't have to manage a rating. We just have to manage a portfolio. And managing a portfolio means you are not in this tight framework. For us, more important is there a sense-making investment out there where a guy can say, "I buy this vessel, I have upside, and I go to Mirabaum to get the finance because I would like to buy three vessels rather than one." And last year, this was not the case for some period. During summer, our business was fairly slow, but not having a budget to meet also means you don't have to do a deal just because end of the quarter your boss will say, "How much have you done?" So we were sitting on our hands for some time, and it picked up in October again. And the deals have been rolling in December, January, like almost never before. So at the moment, business for us is fairly good.
Evan, a bank's perspectives on the state of maritime finance today?
It's interesting. Our story at First Citizens, formerly known as CIT, mirrors a lot of what Martin was saying. So 5 years ago, when banks were leaving the market or there wasn't enough senior lenders, let's say, we restarted a senior lending platform at First Citizens Bank, filling a gap. And we found good clients like Meerbaum and Neptune, both clients for full disclosure, where we helped support filling that gap. So 5 years later, we see plenty of volume bilaterally in club deals, back-levering some of the private equity, plenty of volume. I think the challenge you might be referring to is the repayment velocity. So we have all the money coming back in the door, but we see plenty of good opportunities with good clients, people we trust, and assets we'd like to finance. So the margin discussion is a different story. The pricing is going down, but that's for another question. Huh?
Harris, tell us a bit about your experience this past couple of years. Has anything changed? Are there any lessons learned?
Well, from a geopolitical perspective, a lot has changed, actually. I mean, if you think about the last 3 years, it has been a tremendous period of volatility, and we've seen anything from trade disruptions, choke points in shipping, the Suez Canal, the Panama Canal. We've seen two wars, in the vicinity of Europe. So, yes, it's been a very volatile environment. And typically, shipping thrives in volatile environments, as we've seen. For us, we set up the company 3 years ago on the principles that Martin referred to earlier, on the principle that there is not enough bank financing to go around. And to our surprise, actually, it's turned to be even better than we originally thought. There is a very significant demand. Only last year we quintupled our exposure. Of course, it's easier if you're early in your corporate expansion career. But nevertheless, it proves the point that there's a tremendous demand, and that's for two reasons. First, the first reason is that banks are shying away definitely from the SME type shipping companies. And the second reason is that we have to go through the energy transition, which is sort of a $1 trillion opportunity here in terms of capital deployment. So those two main factors allow us, all of us, to be quite busy in our respective business. And one thing about leasing, of course, is ship leasing in particular, is that our view is that it's going to develop in the same way that the aviation leasing developed over the past, decades. In fact, the aviation leasing covers more than 50% of the value of the, fleet. And in fact, ship leasing is probably 10 to 15% at the moment. So we see a shift happening, and that's what we're here to capture. And one thing about the banks versus leasing companies, I actually think this is a symbiotic relationship. Mm-hmm. We work with our fellow panelists, banks here, work many banks around the world, and I think we're a conduit that allows banks to still be able to serve clients that otherwise they wouldn't have been able to serve. So that's what I would have to say.
Michael, talk a bit about environmental regulations, maybe specifically about the 2023 IMO greenhouse gas strategy. Has that changed your approach to maritime finance at all?
The short answer is no, because I don't want to say we anticipated it happening, because I think people didn't really expect the IMO to be as ambitious as they came out in MEPC 80. But within finance, the Net Zero Banking Alliance, which has about 140, 150 mainly international banks that are signed up to it, is committed to the Paris Agreement to net zero aligned with Paris. So since 2021, particularly 21, when GFANS before the COP in Glasgow, a large part of the international finance community has been on a track to aligning its portfolios with Paris. And there's a key date this year, which is that every bank signed up to that has to target the emissions in all their portfolios for 2030 and 2050 to set targets where their emissions will be in each portfolio. So there's been, if you like, a parallel thing that started before the IMO last July. But what the IMO decisions last July did was, and we heard it in the previous panel, the importance of having a global regulator that sets a standard. And even, as someone said, it's aspirational, there's a sort of expectation that there is now an agenda and a pathway to the IMO aligning with Paris when it next reviews its ambition in 2028. Why that is important is that shipping is the only industry where the true emissions are the real emissions. I mean, I haven't heard anyone from DNV, Lloyd's, or anyone else suggest that what is being measured is wrong. Clearly, there are definitional issues around certain emissions, but we know that the emissions from ships, as measured by the IMO, give you a pretty accurate view of what those emissions are, and I think that's very important. Now, we've seen through the SEC announcement last week that it has balked at defining Scope 3 for US companies, but that's not going to be the case in Europe. But it has issued regulations, if you like, on Scope 1 and Scope 2. So it's bringing together a clear definition of what is Scope 1 and Scope 2 for shipping, at least, if not yet globally for the cargo owners. And that, I think, is very, very important. Because in the end, for certainly the big international banks that are signed up to these other agreements, it's about competition for capital. It is about whether, in an institution like Citi, we will have the capital to allocate to our shipping clients as opposed to our metals and mining clients, our consumer clients. It is, in effect, a competition for the capital in order that we can meet our own net zero requirement. What the IMO did in July, and as I said, I think everyone was pleasantly surprised by the level of its ambition, if not quite Paris-aligned, it, to my mind, it puts shipping as an industry, makes it really credible from the perspective of those of us in the banks who look after the business, that we have, through a global regulator, through the way in which they measure the environmental impact, we have the ability to argue for our clients and for what they are doing. And what it is all about, as you heard before, is about making shipping more efficient. We know the fuels will come eventually, but they're not there yet. But it is making today's shipping industry more efficient, and the reduction of emissions from shipping will help us articulate the right arguments to ask for the capital. Had the IMO not done that, then I think the loss of credibility for shipping as an industry, i.e. the hard-to-abate, dirty industry, would have been more difficult to argue against. And the last thing I want to say on this thing is what we heard this morning is very different from what we would have heard at this event certainly 2 or 3 and certainly 10 years ago, i.e. the industry is now moving in one direction through the collaboration that has been mentioned as being very important to that. So there is now a movement in the industry to really do what it can to become more efficient.
Talking a bit more about regulations and capital, the Basel III endgame, or so-called Basel IV, is coming into effect. Evan, has that had an impact on the way you do business?
It has, not as directly as you would think. We're not a European institution, so it doesn't affect us directly, but our colleague banks and competitor banks are affected by it. So as Michael was mentioning, it's all about competition for capital. How are you going to allocate the capital you have available to you? So in a positive way, it has helped us partner with some of the other senior lenders, predominantly the Europeans, who find us a reliable business partner. They have capital constraints. We don't have those kinds of constraints. So we're able to work with them in that framework, basically taking parts of their deals to be cut to the chase.
Harris, these kinds of regulatory regimes obviously wouldn't affect the way you do business, I wouldn't assume. Does that create opportunities for you?
Well, Basel is not a city that's, you know, favoring ship financiers, really. It's been going from Basel 1, 2, 3, 4, and all the other versions we've seen. And it's making it all, every time it's making it more difficult to, in fact, do asset-based finance, whether shipping or commodities or what have you. If you think about it, it's actually not good for the world trade because it creates barriers to companies accessing low-cost capital. And I think we need to make sure that we lower those barriers. We're not increasing those barriers. And I say this because, on one hand, it's not just finance. On the other hand, it's also the fragmentation that we see in the world markets that is impacting shipping and commodities. And it's a huge market. You know, global trade is $28-29 trillion. So every time there's obstacles to global trade, the cost to the consumers are becoming much higher. So Basel IV is not necessarily good for ship finance. On the other hand, Basel IV is one of the reasons we are here, because as a leasing company, we're not, at the moment at least, we don't need to adhere to Basel IV, and that's why I said we are a conduit between the banks and ship owners. And what happens, and that's why we opted to set up ourselves as a company and not as a fund. We are able, in fact, to work with banks in achieving our targets because we provide a balance sheet, we provide recourse, and we provide certainty of earnings that is actually more difficult to observe if you deal with, you know, shipping companies and SME shipping companies, for that matter.
So we have...
We also provide the knowledge to the smaller companies in order to be able to have access to funding from banks. For a small company having to comply with the forms that banks these days want is very burdensome. If you can hold their hands and you help them through the process, it's a lot easier.
Hmm. Yeah.
And it gives us, as a senior lender, through Mir Baum and through Neptune and a few others, access to those small and medium-sized clients that we like to have. And we couldn't do it if we had to do directly. So thank you for that work.
So what are lenders and lessors looking for in this market? You know, how does your institution stand out in a crowded field? What is your market strategy, Michael?
Our market strategy has never really changed. We have relationships with large ship owners, large shipping companies, with individuals, and we try and help them solve their problems. One of the, just coming back to Baal, I mean, what it will do is force up the cost. And in the end, the cost of shipping is going to be higher anyway because of all the other issues that were touched on earlier, if, of course, the price of decarbonization can be passed on to the end consumer. Fortunately, the industry is in a good place, as Robert Bugby said. You know, he's going to pay down all his debt to scrap value. The industry, broadly speaking, and that includes now the offshore sector and the cruise industry, throwing off cash again, that actually this is a very good time in some way for additional capital burdens to come in the sense that the industry doesn't really need to be borrowing that much. But what will come, and I fully accept the room that this helps create for Harris and Martin, but what will come is financing the cost of decarbonization. The fuels will come, the new ships have to come, and that is going to be much more expensive. And that is where the industry is going to have to tap the capital markets. And that is where the investors also are going to be looking for definitions around scope 1, 2, and actually 3 from a container cargo perspective. So in a way, it's about positioning for that. It's about not being, you know, in those times gone past where this table was full of restructuring people. The industry is in a very good place. And so chasing deals, it just doesn't make sense for an institution like us. We're a relationship cash flow lender, if you like. We don't finance assets because of the value of an asset. And it is one of those rare periods where ship owners are prepaying. And I think, as we heard in the first panel, the market is likely to mean that goes on for some time. But the investments, and this is the change that's happened on the owning side, even though people don't know what decisions to make yet in some sectors, they know they're going to have to make decisions at some time. And so you've seen this in the way in which some of the dual-fueled ordered ships have shifted away from now methanol, or away from LNG towards methanol and now ammonia. So there are decisions being made now that will need financing in 2 to 3 years' time. And so being ready for that, I think, is just as important. What I would say on the Baal issue, it's obviously not over yet, at least in the US. There's an opportunity, and the banks are pushing back on the regulators to try and make the Baal endgame more tolerable. What does need to happen, though, is that regulators in different fields really ought to start talking to each other. You will not finance the decarbonization of the global economy if you make banks unable to fulfill their purpose, which is to finance investment in the necessary change. So there still needs to be the political coming together, and whether that's through COPs or some other mechanism, so that there is some incentive for the banking system to work with private capital to help make those investments. The issue around the fuels is not, I don't think we've heard from anyone, the fuels can't exist. It's about the financing of the scale of production of those fuels and the investment in the onboard and the vessels and the onboard technology on the vessels to make that work. So that is around really finance and the commitment by different people to make those decisions. And I think increasingly that's what shipping finance will be, and less about the individual ship. But there will always be room in this very broad, fragmented market for different types of finances, as represented on this panel.
What about you, Evan? Does your market strategy, has it changed at all in this evolving landscape?
No, it has not.
Short answer. Yeah.
I'm trying to pick up a few of the threads from Michael, because the two institutions are somewhat different. Michael's talking about not focusing on the assets, but focusing on the corporate. If I could. We focus on the owner and the asset, but focusing on the owner, today we have 35 clients, and we try to know them as well as possible. Let's say we like stay in touch with another 25 or 30. So there are 60, 70 companies. We'd like to understand, how are they preparing for what's coming? Are they looking realistically at the different options? How are they going to operate the assets? Which assets are they choosing? Because in this cyclical business, there are always changes coming, whether it's going to be the capital requirements for new investments, new technologies, or, I don't want to say it too loud, when market rates come down, but how are these clients preparing? So, no, we're still following our same strategy. Know our clients well. Senior lending, which I've said a few times, sounds a bit boring, but it can be quite flexible. So in the flexibility of senior lending, one of the unique attributes we have as an American institution is we're able to be flexible in a different way from some of our European colleagues. We can be less rigid about age, for example, and some clients in the room will know that we're more rigid about other things, but it's not that funny, but okay. So our approach to the market hasn't changed. It's about the owner. It's about the asset. It's about knowing who we're working, who our business partners are.
Harris, what is your target market? What kind of owner would get the best results from working with your institution?
So our typical client, and it's about a similar number, actually, that Evan just said. We have about 30 active clients at the moment, and about the same number of past or non-active clients. is a family business or an individual, small, medium-sized owner that is in principle bankable. So in the old days, alternative finance was a bit like financing the dodgy guys that no one wants. We see that differently. We finance the guys that in the past would have received money from banks like DVB or Deutsche Schiffsbank or Royal Bank. And we give them a one-shop solution. So when they go out investing, they get the private equity for the higher chunk, and they get the senior lending coming from banks or insurances. And we bundle all that, so he doesn't have to deal with everyone. He deals with us. And that enables a client to buy a vessel to compete with the big guys, with the cash buyers, and trade spot rather than in a low market having to fix also for, like, forever. And we also don't require all sorts of bells and whistles like a retention account for a dry docking that is 5 years down the road, which some banks want because they need to tick that box. So basically, banking for adults enabling a client to be fast in the S&P market, not taking undue risk, and he gets the same supervision from us as if he was V-Ships managing a vessel that we put equity in.
The same question to you, Harris. What is your target market?
Well, when we started, we thought we're going to be focusing only on SMEs, so small and medium-sized companies, because that's where the gap was. Actually, if you think about it, 60% of the fleet is owned by, you know, small and medium-sized operators, and these were the ones that were left unattended. But as we grow bigger, we started realizing, because of our ability to, you know, have also attractive cost of funds, that we're able to do business with also much larger companies. So we actually moved in parallel to dealing with SMEs, also to dealing with larger companies. We've done new building financing as well recently. And so we're happy that we have a much more diversified pool of owners. That's one. The second issue is that we're quite focused on the asset. We're looking at the quality of the asset very carefully, also because of the energy transition discussion that we had earlier, because we need to make sure that the assets have the longevity that is required to meet our, you know, financing requirements. But we're not shying away from financing older ships. And there are two reasons for that. First of all, we need them. The world trade needs them. Actually, if you look at...
older, Harris?
How do I define older? But let me finish my sentence first. So the average age of the world fleet is now 12.6 years. It used to be 9.7 in 2013. That is older. That's like 3-4 yeah. years older than what we had. And actually, 32% of the fleet is more than 15 years of age. So there's quite a lot of older ships out there that need to be, you know, financed one way or the other.
What you're doing is you're financing the mid-sized, mid-aged fleet, not the old ones, not the 31-year-olds.
31 is a bit excessive, I would say, yes. but the point that I was trying to make is that, you know, why do we do this? Because if all of us make a decision not to fund the ships that are older, actually... what you'll see is that 45% of the fleet by the year 2026, which is the implementation of, you know, the CII rules, 45% of the fleet will be in D or E categories, which means that half the fleet won't be able to trade, essentially, if we do nothing today, if we do any retrofits. So how are we going to make sure that the world keeps on feeding itself if suddenly 50% of the fleet, you know, moves out of the market? It's impossible. So that's why we fundamentally believe that we need to help owners go through the energy transition. That's why we call it transition. It's not just going out and ordering, you know, 100 new buildings. It's also making sure that there's enough ships going around by the time the new buildings come into the market. So we help owners with retrofits, and we actually have quite a lot of our clients opting for these 10-year-old, 11-year-old, or 12-year-old ships that need the extra, you know, rectification, retrofit, propeller, you know, bubbles blow, whatever
it
is.
The investment and the finance.
Correct. Yeah. And so that's what we do, and why we do it.
So there's a lot going on here, and we can probably pick each one of these themes and have a separate panel. But what's next for shipping offshore and maritime finance? You know, trying to predict the future is a fool's errand, but where do you see these industries in 5 to 10 years? We'll start with you, Michael.
Well, I said it last year, so I'll say it again. I mean, I think very different, but you don't, you know, you look back and see how much things have changed. You don't necessarily feel it as you're living through it. But I think we talked about the IMO and MEPC 80. The ETS scheme has now come into effect in the EU. Lots of ship owners scrabbling around to actually work out what that means. Other EU legislation has come in just on environmental reporting that affects every medium-sized and large company. So even though the tone of the politics on the environment is different here, it's not different in Europe. And I think, as was said on the first panel, and certainly by Bud, you know, we have a global industry with a global regulator. What goes on within cabotage and shipping that isn't regulated by the IMO, of course, is subject to other jurisdictions. But I think the missing piece we haven't yet talked about is the drive of cargo owners, and particularly in the container sector. It is the container sector which represents the end consumer, the bit that people saw when the Ever Given was stuck in the Suez Canal, the white vans or whatever, DHL vans or whatever during COVID. It is the end consumer of the container business that is actually politically putting more drive behind this. And I think you're going to see increasingly those big companies like Amazon, Target, Unilever, the members of the COSEV Alliance and the piece underneath it, the Zero Emission Buyers Alliance, you're going to see them driving a lot of the investment in the technological change or the fuel buying, if you like. And that will need financing. And I think other sectors, which have been, you know, the first panel, they will follow that. They don't know what to order yet because they don't know which is going to make more sense for them. But I think the container sector, because of the cargo owners, will be the ones that drive the pace of that. But also remember the IMO's agenda between now and 25 for implementation in 26 and 27 is fairly significant. And this year, the CII ratings should become publicly available. And we know they will be reviewed and finalized by the end of 25. So there's a lot going on in the industry. We have, you know, the Baal endgame affecting the big regulated banks. So there is a lot that I think will fundamentally change this industry simply because from a regulatory perspective, from a cargo perspective, as well as a risk perspective, the business we all do will become very different. The fragmentation of the industry will take a lot longer before that really changes, and that's why there will always be room for different types of institution to provide finance, but I think we'll see the bigger end of the industry go back to the public markets, the capital markets, and there'll be banks like Citi that do that regularly that will help them do that. And hopefully with better incentives for the banking system to support genuinely green or going green type investment, we'll see regulators begin to align on that. But it is a transition, and it's going to take a long time. Personally, I believe that nuclear will play a much bigger part, but that'll be in the 40s. I certainly won't be here then, but that probably will be the long-term solution, whether it's in the creation of the fuels or reactors on large container ships, bulk carriers, cruise ships, or the sort of ships that go on the sort of routes that would happen. So shipping will decarbonize, there's no question about that, and finance is going to be key to that. But it'll be very visible, I think, in 5 and certainly in 10 years' time, that a lot of the things that all of us on this panel did 10 years ago really will be, a little bit of it will still be there, but a lot of that will have changed because of regulation.
Evan, the thoughts on the future of maritime finance?
I got lost when you said offshore before, so I don't think about that very often. And nuclear, I don't know about. I think it continues. I mean, is it 90% of everything goes on board a ship? So we're going to still be putting stuff on ships. The future of maritime finance. So it is going to be, can you be, and I hate the cliche word, nimble enough to adapt? So there's a new sanction coming out next week, and there's a new emissions trading regulation starting on January 1st. And are your clients able to adapt to that quickly enough? Are you able to manage that information quickly enough? So it's being that quick and keeping your team and your business that quick, that's the challenge going forward. And voila, so whatever sanctions come up, whatever new things come up, that's what we have to be able to manage.
Martin, where do you see your institution in 5 or 10 years? Are you nimble enough to meet the demands of?
Well, I think, tenfolding like we did the first 10 years is probably difficult. But if the market continues to split the way it has and the leasing alternative finance part becomes bigger and bigger, I'd certainly like to keep the position we're in and be one of the first choices that people call if they have a need.
Harris, where do you see your institution in 5 or 10 years? How do you stay competitive in this changing marketplace?
I think there's a tremendous opportunity now ahead of us because, you know, Michael knows a lot about it, of course, because, and with congratulations to him, he was one of the front runners that saw the change in relation to environmental legislation requirements, and he put together Poseidon Principles. So chapeau to Michael in that respect. But the world decided to decarbonize. In COP28, the world made the decision to triple the amount of nuclear energy that was referred to earlier, triple the amount of renewable energy. And these are green electrons, but we need to change the green electrons into green molecules in order to transport them, because otherwise, you know, they're stranded. So that's why I believe shipping has a tremendous, growth ahead of it. We need a lot of ships to transport these green molecules and decarbonize the world economy. And our company is going to be there to support owners in their growth ambitions. So absolutely.
We're starting to run out of time. Just a quick survey. I'm a lending lawyer by training, and it wasn't that long ago that we used to put in a provision in a loan agreement that says LIBOR can't be less than zero. Where do we think the SOFR term rate is going to be at the end of this year? I think today it's about 5.3%. Michael?
I have no idea.
Evan?
It'll be lower. How about that? Slightly better than no idea.
Martin?
Well, I think Liverpool will make it this year.
Harris?
It'll be lower. But what concerns me more than SOFR is the sort of what happens with elections around the world this year, because I think that's going to determine the fate of SOFR as well. And I see that, if around the world we have political parties that favor protectionism, that's going to be a little bit of a black swan for trade and transportation.
We have a minute left. Is that what keeps you up at night? What are you worried about your business, Harris?
I just mentioned what keeps me up at night.
Okay. Martin?
Well, what keeps me up at night is seafarers that are endangered, to be honest. If you know that a vessel that you know of is going into harm's way, and there's some idiots out there that think attacking vessels, killing seamen, is another way of doing politics. It's not nice. And same during COVID, when people had heart attacks on board and the helicopters couldn't go onshore because the people wouldn't let them to be treated in a hospital in the country and they died on board. This keeps me awake at night.
Evan?
No, very, very well said. So it's the safety of the ships and the crew. Then you think about the safety of your own business, because charity begins at home. And then it's the black swans of whatever sanctions comes next. And none of us want to wake up to hear that some ship was detained in a place it shouldn't have been
to begin with.
Michael.
I think Robert Bugbee sort of hinted that how the Middle East could develop could actually be much worse than we're currently seeing, and I think that risk of global conflict when a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council is effectively at war with another country in Europe, and there's other instability, that I think is worrying for all of us. The effect on shipping is sometimes good, sometimes bad, but I think as Martin said and as Knut mentioned, the issue for this industry is ultimately about the seafarer and getting the seafarer recognized as an essential worker for the risks they take. I mean, the fact that seafarers who did not want to sail into the Red Sea were told that they would lose their jobs, can you imagine that in any other environment? So there's still a long way to go, and I think collectively the industry has to put more emphasis not just on the skills which Knut talked about, but also on the risks that they take. And if there's one issue beyond obviously decarbonisation that collectively the industry could really work on and lobby for, would be how seafarers are treated.
On that sobering note, that's our panel. Thanks to the panel. Thanks to the audience. Enjoy the conference.